Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Jim, you just reminded me that our 13th anniversary is coming up on July 24th, and so I thought it might be fun to go back and talk about some of the things that we've done over the last 13 years and how accurate we've been on things. And I think one of the ones that was the most interesting was, I believe it was you wrote an article about the capture of Saddam Hussein was imminent, and it happened like either a day or two after we posted the article. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was that was basically luck, I have to admit. But the techniques we use in our pieces, which is based upon, you know, predictive analysis, operations research, or a lot of it started out, you know, with the war games and what have you. But all the technology that goes into those predictive games is the background that we bring to developing this material. We published about 30,000 items, you know, in the last 13 years. I think I've written about close to 2/3 of those. But anyway, the original idea behind Strategy Page, which we admitted early on, was as a way for Austin and I to keep our books current. I did How to Make War, and the two of us did Quick and Dirty Guide to War, which have both gone through, I think, about 6 editions. And I don't think there will be any more editions because we do such a great job of updating that material in Strategy Page. I mean, that's why you have the organization. A lot of people don't realize it, but if you look at the organization of, you know, the How to Make War section, it's the chapters from How to Make War, which is still in print and has been for, I guess, what, 30 years now. That's right, I forgot about that too. This is the 30th anniversary of the first edition of How to Make War. And of course, all that geek stuff, the predictive analysis and the war games and what have you, you find more and more in the mass media. When we started out back in the 60s, early 60s, late 60s, early 70s, it was truly bizarre stuff to most people. It was magic. And it stayed that way for, you know, 10 or 20 years, as I sort of expected. I mean, I knew it worked. I was running into a lot of people in the military who knew it worked. But for the vast majority of people, including most journalists, it was just, you know, magic. But now that computers have come along and more people have been exposed to, you know, high-order math in applications, I mean, they don't understand the math, but they know how to use it, which is the important thing. And they know that it works because they can basically play with it. When you can play with a tool, you can figure out, you know, what works and what doesn't work. It's like a kid, you know, with their little play tools. They're not real tools because the kid's going to bang body parts and do stupid things with his plastic tools. But he, or increasingly she, is going to learn that there are things you can do with a saw or a hammer that, and things that you don't do, simply by experience. And this whole growth in the accessibility, the access to, you know, simulation technology and basically what we call and describe, you know, repeatedly predictive analysis and what have you, is what makes our material so accurate. It's not magic. You know, we try and explain it, but, you know, most people, it just goes over the head, you know, and the people who already understand this is not, I know that, you know, they're engineers or some kind of geek and they don't want to be bothered by the, you know, predictive analysis 101 again. But our track record stands up pretty well. And Austin and I both know this because a lot of, we use our own archive. You know, you go into the search capability facility in Strategy Page, and we both use it, and we're constantly finding stuff, you know, especially stuff we wrote. Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, that's pretty good. Because the attitude is, why write the same thing all over again? You might be able to improve it. But we often find that you keep coming back to the same subjects, you know, the same material, you know, why is there a fifth generation fighter over the other generations? Development, evolution of infantry tools, Marine Corps, you know, tactics, and development of certain, you know, weapons and techniques, little wars. I mean, you know, we were the ones who were right up front, with, you know, what was happening after the 03 invasion, you know, why there was going to be a guerrilla war. I mean, it was obvious to us. I mean, we, Austin and I, had written many times, I've gone through several editions, of what was going on, what Iraq was all about. And a lot of other people out there were, too. A small minority of the population, it's true. But, you know, this stuff was no secret. And if you basically went and got the facts, I mean, there are certain facts on the ground in the Middle East, you can usually put together, you know, well, what's what. I mean, Austin and I, for example, were on, what was that TV show, Nightline, describing the game Austin designed, the Arabian Nightmare. You know, we basically, they said, you know, well, you know, how accurate is this? And I said, oh, pretty close to 100%. You know, is that much really going to happen? I said, yeah. He says, you know, it's going to be, you know, we're going to win quick. I says, of course. And he's tried to sound incredulous, but, you know, nobody in the media came back and patted us on the back after it was all over. Well, they sort of did, you know, me up at NBC. I don't know about you, Austin, down in the Pentagon. There it was, and it was obvious to us. And that's what a lot of the people, a half million or so regular users we got, that's what, you know, the fan mail we do get. That's what it says, you know, I could basically get right down to the, you know, the essentials of a seemingly complex, you know, situation, a new weapon system, a war, an obscure war, and, you know, basically get to the essence of it in 5 minutes. Because people don't take a lot of time on the internet. I mean, we know that from the fact that we track everything. You know, we're no better than Google or Amazon. I mean, there are tools that basically, you know, not show the person's name, but show, you know, this particular user or these, you know, the 1,000 users that came in, you know, in this 10-minute period. They spend so many seconds on that, so many seconds on that. You know, how many hits each, you know, how many views or, you know, each item gets. But one thing that everybody running a successful web page knows, people will not read a lot of one thing. You got to be quick, you got to be to the point, and move the hell on, because people are simply not going to put up with it. It's real democracy in action. That's why a lot of professional journalists probably don't like it. They like to have things their way. I mean, their attitudes, everybody's considered, to my opinion, and nobody else's. But we basically embrace, you know, the reality of the internet. And given the obscure nature of, you know, a lot of the things we're covering, it seems to work.
Right. Austin, what do you remember most over the last 13 years?
Well, I'll tell you, I want to pick on a couple of things that Jim said. One thing is that I think that Jim is dead on right in his, you know, historical statement about what we were doing from the get-go, as he says, in embracing the capabilities of the internet. In part, and I can trace this to the way that Jim ran simulations publications back when in the 70s, 80s, and the research on the background of the games. Also, you know, Al Nofi's in this as well, is because you're dealing with, you know, Jim's this way, I'm this way, Nofi's this way. We're research mavens. I was about to say research hogs, but the thing is, there is something to that. I mean, our readers, that in depth, and what the internet allows you to do. Jim saying, you know, Google, Bing, all the search engines, and also hitting, you know, websites, sometimes obscure websites as well, is it speeds up the ability to do what the research that used to take me when I would go down to the library and just sit and flip through about 6 months of Foreign Broadcast Information Service, FBIS, which was the way the it was a CIA publication all research libraries subscribed to, but it would have selected translations of speeches, news statements from all over the world. Well, now you can get all that much faster. Another comment, and this is an elaboration on something Jim alluded to, is that we're bringing it together in a coherent and fairly short. There's a few times we'll get a little bit longer, but most of the stuff, especially the way we present it, take a look at it. It's in chunks or paragraphs of 4 or 5 sentences at the most. Now, it could be linked longer in update, and there's some, there's several that, you know, are running 200 or 300 words. And then if you move to the weekly on point column thing I do for Creator Syndicate, there you're looking at pretty much standard 680, 700 word newspaper type column. But we're still being synthetic in the we're synthesizing the essentials here for you. And we're not presenting ourselves as having some inside line, secret data, secret sources, as certain other websites and organizations have. That's, and really, in my view, after having looked in depth at several of them, they're not doing anything any different than we are. They're just making a claim that I, as someone who has had the privilege of working in, you know, the military on operations and coming in contact with the classified world, the people who really do know the secrets don't talk. Because that's the responsibility of it, rules and the like, and what they, if it's given out, that's given out in leaks, and leaks, and they have an agenda with them. Now, ours is, you're getting the work of Jim Dunnigan, Al Nofi, Austin Bay, and the other stringers and contributors that we have that flow through Jim's editorial, Jim acting the editor on it. So you're what we did is all of that, you know, the research background, research talents, the internet and microcomputers permit us just to do it faster. And to get to the technique of research, and then also having a knack for presenting essentials in a compact, and I've heard Jim use the word digestible fashion. Okay, well, the food is slightly pre-chewed, folks, because we think that's what you want, and we respect your time. Jim also said, you know, you're looking at how to make war, and quick and dirty guide to war. Dan, I just went with this before you asked me to elaborate on it. I went and looked up the first post I wrote in the Kurdish War article index, and it's dated August 28, 1999. That's when we first picked it up. Now, the Kurdish War is now far less obscure because of the rise in importance of Turkey, also the greater familiarity because of 9/11, and then Iraq, and then now Syria with the Kurds as well. There's a much higher profile. Some of these things that were obscure, and who was writing? I don't want Jim to answer this now, but who was writing about the Kurdish War in 1999? I'll tell you, Dan. Very, you would see things crop up in some of occasionally in elite international media. You would see occasionally comments in a magazine like The Economist, but virtually no one else. And it was one of the reasons that we consciously picked up on it is because Turkey's a NATO nation, and they had a live, hardcore insurgency that with roots back roots go deep, and Kurds being at war with numerous other ethnic and national groups around them for centuries, arguably millennia, but here was the origins of the Kurdistan Workers' Party was they were a communist Marxist organization, buffed up by the Soviet Union. Remember back in the Cold War to undermine a key NATO ally, Turkey. And we thought, heck, people need to write about it. Jim and I had written about it in three different editions of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War. So if somebody wants to go look at it, go into the the Kurdish War article index, hit 1999, and then the first one down there on August 28, 1999. And they're just three short bits about things that are going on, clashes and fights. And then you can see in this particular one, really the origin of it from A Quick and Dirty Guide to War, because I wrote a little background piece. Some of it I took out of a chapter that appeared in the 92 edition, When the Flank Begins to Fray, I believe was the title of it there, and it was about Turkey. But I went and punched some things out of much shorter than it does in the Quick and Dirty Guide to War chapter, because I know this is the first time we're going to cover this, but people who need to know something, because this is not something that's on the front burner, the back burner, even in the oven. It's maybe on a hot plate in the very back of the warehouse in terms of most people's awareness of it. And yet it was a war that involved, directly involved, a major NATO ally of the United States. That's in part how we selected. That wasn't the only criteria by any means, but that's how we picked up on that particular conflict to cover. Go through it. You'll see some of the earliest pieces in Africa, and I'm right here. Here's one that I happened to be looking at about 3 months ago, because it was Sudan, and we have the first Sudan post is dated August 31st, 1999, and I remember writing that. There were some reasons I wrote that, because. And you can also see it going back, even though July 24th was our first date. I started that particular file on July 19th, 1999. And it was, again, I thought I had to explain something about the war. Let me read just the paragraph at the top. SPLA leader John Garang held talks in Cairo with Egyptian officials to discuss the Egyptian-Libyan peace plan for ending Sudan's 16-year-long civil war. Egypt's plan calls for, quote, an immediate halt of military operations and media campaigns by all parties. And then if it goes through the things that had happened by date in this, who was covering Sudan? Remember, this was before Darfur, and Darfur becoming a, not that there wasn't trouble in Darfur, but becoming a cause celeb. There was more focus on Sudan, and you know, I'll say in mainstream media, because of the slaving allegations that had been going on. They weren't as allegations. The northern Sudan, the Khartoum, had been slaving in the south, as Jim puts it, the Arabs versus the the black Africans centuries, millennia, but that had a headline capability for major media. We can write about that. People identify with it. Well, in our case, it was, this is the largest country in Africa, Sudan. It is a menagerie of wars, many of them that have the chance of breaking into a larger sub-Saharan war, or even in the Arab Black Africa conflict. They talk about the great fault line running between Arab and influenced Africa and Black Africa, and so that's one reason we picked up on that. Picked up on it. I had looked at this, and I also looked at a 2003, I'm going to argue that Strategy Page was one of the first places to really pick up on the trouble that became specifically the Darfur War. You have to look in the February, various posts of February 2003, and for some reason here, I've just gone to it. I think it's February 26th. Let's see. The Front for the Liberation of, I did it. Here it is. Front for the Liberation of Darfur, FLD, yet another Sudanese rebel group, took control of the capital of Jebel Marah province. The capital is named Gulu, not to be confused with Gulu in North Uganda. Western reports said the FLD put at least 300 fighters into the fight. For years, the Sudanese government, Khartoum, has armed nomadic Arabized and Muslim tribes of Darfur. These militias have attacked Zaghawa and Fur tribes in Darfur, Fur as in Darfur. Now the FLD is striking back, allegedly on behalf of minority tribes. Now, the source of that, I followed some of this, but I believe it was an Agence France-Presse, an AFP report, plus there are other sites that I have looked at in sub-Saharan Africa over the years, primarily sectarian, Dan. I mean, I look at Catholic, Anglican, but not only sectarian aid organizations, but some of the other smaller medical and food aid organizations. Occasionally go hit their sites, and you'd see what they'd have reports on there. Many of them 5 or 6 weeks after events from refugees that had showed up in their various the various places that they actually were running aid operations and say, oh, we got attacked by so-and-so. And those had been filtering in over a period of time. I bring this up and say, here's something that we brought out. The FLD, by the way, later changed its name into the Justice and Equality Movement, the JEM, J-E-M, and then added some other, they really formed an umbrella political organization. They tried to emulate the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, that's what John Garang had been head of, which was the Southern Sudanese Liberation Army and Southern Sudan People's Liberation Movement. Now, I'll end this wrap talking about how we selected it and giving you some specific examples on it. What we've got now is 13 years of archives that you can look at the progress, or in Sudan's case, continual misery. Even though a huge change in that South Sudan after the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement has seceded or become independent. That's the view of the South, the North, as they seceded last year. And we've got another North-South war, frozen this time over oil. But the depth is already there on strategy page, and it's depth that's in, as Jim says, digestible bites.
Yeah, something else that's changed a lot in the last 13 years is Internet. Widespread internet use, and I guess about 8 years ago, we started, or at least I started, to get a lot of emails from people in areas where there was a war going on. In some cases, they were referred, like in Iraq, they were referred to by soldiers who were regular users. Say, hey, because I'd let it be known that we always accept information or whatever. A lot of it was very partisan. And you had to be careful, you had to always double or triple check, whatever you were told. But often, it didn't take much time or much effort, using the web, to separate, the partisanship from, the few facts that are lurking in there. And that has led us to not only a lot of information, but to a lot of insights that we reached before the mainstream media got to it. Because they do not use this ground, truth, and they don't analyze as much as we do. For example, one thing I noticed in Iraq, a lot of the mainstream media, the majority of English-speaking Iraqis were Sunnis. And they had a very different, the two things the Sunnis, either one, they were better educated. Second, they were desperate because they were the minority. They were in a favored position when Saddam was in power. They didn't all work for Saddam, but let's face it, most 80% of the oil income went to the Sunnis, who were 20% of the population. So you don't have to be a mathematician to figure out how that works. But a lot of these guys had an agenda. And I've had a couple of journalists admit to me, after the fact, and they shall remain nameless for their honesty, that, they had been played. And one of these guys was a user of Strategy Page, and he picked up on that from mentions in Strategy Page. And he went and had a heart-to-heart with a couple of his, cameramen, or, you know, they use a lot of stringers in Iraq because it's not safe for an American civilian to go outside the wire, as it were. So a lot of them, yeah, I think as Austin would often point out, it was like Vietnam. They'd stay at the swimming pool, you know, and have a cool drink and basically give orders to their local, you know, their native stringers, as it were. But anyway, eventually, a lot of the reporters wised up, and they figured out what was going on. But another thing we discovered was that a lot of mainstream, you know, reporters would send back the truth to their editor, and the editor would say, and I've gotten this from, you know, some editors over the years, you know, in the United States, that's not what we want. And they weren't talking about factual problems. They were talking about, you know, that's not the reality we're pushing. And you get some of these guys over a few drinks and whatnot, and if you have a reputation for not, you know, naming names, they'll admit it. I've gotten the same thing down in Washington, D.C. from government bureaucrats. There's a certain way you do these. Now, we've explained this in Strategy Page. A lot of people say, well, so what? But it's part of our campaign to try and explain the world as it is, not how we'd like it to be.
Yeah, we're residents of Realville.
Yeah, which is not a popular place.
Right. The interesting thing about Strategy Page is that the URL has been registered since 1996. That's when I got involved in the internet about that time. I don't know if you remember this, Jim. That's when we started taking the Hundred Years' War over to the internet.
Yes,
which
yes,
was a
yes.
Game
AOL,
that we had worked
yeah.
on together, right?
And we were talking about all sorts of things you could do on the internet.
Right.
Who knew?
And, yeah, and really the internet had only existed as the World Wide Web for 2 years at that point. And we had started using it, and then until my professional career cleared up a little bit in 1999, we launched. But we were lucky at that time that FYEO, which was actually a newsletter at the time, a printed newsletter done by Stephen Cole, of Starfleet Battles fame, went up for sale, and we started using that as sort of our format, and then we mixed it in with How to Make War and Quick and Dirty Guide to War, and it's evolved over the 13 years.
Well, the thing to remember about FYEO was I originally invented that back in the late 70s, and then I moved on, and he bought it.
Right.
I don't know if he was running it for a while. And then he got tired of running it as a paper publication, and he basically sold it to us, you know, if we would assume the subscription liability, which we had no problem doing because, you know, we were giving it away anyway.
Right.
But it was a win-win for both of us. And he indeed continued to contribute a lot of material for, I think, about 2 years after that. And we still get, he still sends us corrections and what have you. We still hear from him. He's still out there.
There are a number of things that Cole wrote in those first 2 years.
We've always been turning out about 40 or 50 new items a week, which is a bit of a chore. I mean, as Austin points out, it's only possible because you can do a lot of your research on the internet. The other advantage we have, you know, especially myself, Austin, and Al, we've got decades of experience in this area, subject matter experts. So a lot of times I can pick up on something from memory and then confirm it or get it, you know, focused, as it were, corrected, you know, via searching the internet. Also, when you're that experienced, again, don't try this at home, kids, unless you got a decade or so under your belt. We got good BS detectors. So, you know, when you see something on the internet, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it must be the truth. But Austin and I or Al or even Dan will look at that and say, no, I don't know. And so we avoid a lot of embarrassing situations, which we have had very few of.
Right, right. Mostly we get knocked for some of our grammar errors, and that's because of the speed that we put things out at.
Well, not only that, that keeps us humble, and it reminds people that this is the internet, and you're not paying for it.
Right.
Grammar. And remember, it was Mark Twain who said, "I don't trust anyone who can't spell something more than one way."
That's right. I don't think a lot of people realize, you know, when they see Strategy Page up there, they think that we're some sort of big organization. But
None of us work full time. There's four of us that spend more time on it than anybody else. We have a couple of other people that contribute here and there, but it's not a full time vocation for any of us. Although I think probably sometimes, Jim, you feel that way.
No, I keep track of my time. I spend about 20 hours a week.
Right.
It's my hobby, as it were.
And
at my age, late 60s, it's probably the safest hobby I could be doing. I mean, even golf seems like a strain at this point. Although I still go out running, but at least I'm not going to get hit by some little white ball.
Right. Now, one of the things that was interesting was when blogs started to appear, we had been around for several years by that time, and people started saying, oh, we're a blog.
And it
took us a while to shake that we weren't a blog, we were our own thing. And we've never tried to be something that somebody else already is, and I think that's been part of our success. We've been us.
Yeah, well, not only that, but the blog format was basically an easy way for most people to regularly put out information. Now, we had a lot of information. Ours was organized. And that's why we stayed the way we were. I mean, we did talk about, gee, we should become a blog. And then, you know, we realized that, well, you know, what's a blog? It's a way to transmit information over the Internet. We already have a workable way. You know, as the old saying goes, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. We've modified it a lot over the years. But the basic truth of Strategy Page, which we explain in the who, you know, you go up there, there's a link, say, you know, who we are. It explains things like Dan just said this one before, the four main people who are all part-timers. But it also explains, basically, we're doing analysis, not history. That's why we don't do breaking stories. That's not right. What we're about. We will do something that, you know, is ongoing, but we'll do it as a form of analysis, not as reporting, you know, breaking news. We don't break the news. We predict the news.
Right.
And a lot of people don't catch that. That's a good catchphrase. I don't think we've used that one before.
Yeah, we predict the news. I think that would be a good one. One of the things that I think we'll end with is it actually brought the site down, and it was one of the most obscure reasons to have the site brought down. It was one of the few times Drudge linked to us.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the polar bear picture.
Oh, yes, those damn polar bears.
And can you give us
really important news, folks?
Right.
A polar bear munching on a nuclear submarine. It's got some value, sure. But please.
Yeah, the pictures arrived in your email box. We didn't know where they came from, but they had been taken by...
Well, I know where they came from, but I should add, I don't know if we ever mentioned this. I got chewed out by a bunch of Navy, you know, submarine sailor wives who were being harassed, you know, endlessly by the security people because they were the first, they got blamed.
Right, because they
got... You set these pictures to those goddamn wet people. And they were not happy about that.
Right, the pictures appeared, the Navy wives of the submariners all got called into a big room and chewed out by some bureaucrat in the Navy about why did they release those photos to the web, because this is... violated operational security. Well,
you know who really released them? I don't know if we ever mentioned this. I don't give a damn at this point. It was a civilian contractor who was on the sub. You know, there's always a bunch of civilian, you know, geeks on there, you know, working on one thing or another. He's the one who, when they said, hey, guys, look at this, they weren't using the electronic periscope at that point, but they did have a digital camera hooked up to it. And the contractor was all geek. He whipped out something or other, you know, some electronic gadget, and he immediately took the pictures. And then, since he had access to the Internet for job purposes, he managed to... They were low res. I mean, they were not high res pictures. And he basically zapped them back and said, hey, this is ha-ha-ha, look at this, pass it around. And
yeah.
Somebody didn't realize you're not supposed to pass them around outside the group of people who have a security clearance. And
right.
That's how I got them. And I was on a distribution list, and at first I said, you know, what harm can this do? You know, not realizing, you know, that some security wall, whatever you want to call them, at the Pentagon will go ballistic because nuclear submarines are so secret, and the fact that they're vulnerable to polar bear attack, my God, you know, where could that end? and we just put them up there. But, you know, they were basically, for most people, they were just a bit of, you know, entertainment. Ha ha, look
right.
at that. New yeah. attraction in Disneyland.
Well, right. you know, actually, Dan, you raise a question, though, that all of us, Jim and I and Alan, all talk about it. There are some things when Jim's saying you're predicting the news, really what we're doing is it's not so much a prediction as an indication of a trend, you know. But that's this is a probable outcome, you know. But it's and I guess that's a prediction of sorts. But the thing is,
we've been very good with the operational security. I mean, this goes back
exactly
to '91 during the Gulf War. When I was working for NBC and they were going to jump on some story, I said, no, wait a minute. I call up Boston, who was working down in the Pentagon. I said, could you run the checks, find out if this is going to get anybody killed? And a couple of times, Austin came back and said, yeah, they're a little touchy about that one. And usually it had something to do with special operations, you know, inside of Iraq or whatever.
And part of it is the experience that we have and respect for, heck, guys, I've done it. Jim has done it. We've both been soldiers, and we're sensitive to it. But the thing is, a picture of a polar bear chewing on a nuclear submarine—that's going to get out, Dan.
Right.
It's too much. You know, that's the thing. Look at that, and the fact that Drudge snapped to it. It shows you, weird stuff with animals and weird weather, you're going to be on the Drudge Report, you know?
That's
right.
Either
else, it's going to end up on the Drudge Report, so.
Well, it's been a fun 13 years, and I'm looking forward to another fun 13 years.
Yeah, lucky 13.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
All right. I'm looking at it. Until next time.
You guys next time.
Bye, guys. Bye.